Hello everyone. This time I decided to conduct this class by using a podcast. So our first topic is product innovation management. Many of these themes have already been covered during the bachelor's course, but I want to deep dive into some of the key concepts that might be actually useful when you are working on your live case studies as well. So on my courses, you can find the slide deck for lecture one, and going directly to the page number 3, where I elaborate the concept of newness to the firm. If you think about product innovation management, we should take a very wide perspective and don't get stuck with the concept of products, physical products only. The same frameworks and concepts apply to service businesses, project-based solutions businesses, as well as the typical product-driven companies. If we look at the companies today, very few of them are dependent only on one type of offering. Many product companies are becoming more and more service-driven. Many service companies are becoming increasingly conceptualized and moving towards products and anything in between. So the first thing we need to understand is that how new is the innovation, the offering innovation to the firm. Many times actually companies get very excited about the innovations that are new to them. And at first, they forget that the innovation might not be that new to the market. So in a way, they are fussing about something that is, you know, like just an addition to an existing category from the consumer's or the user's perspective, but that is just simply new to them. Every single company needs to find the right balance between newness and oldness. Building on what you already have, that is something what we call exploitation. That resembles the logic of a factory. Trying to maximize the output, getting rid of any defects and process issues. It's all about building a well-oiled machine where actually the performance can be maximized. Oftentimes, exploitation can be measured directly by looking at revenue, margin, and profit. But on top of that, companies do explore, and that's the logic of an adventure. They try out new things they haven't been working with before. Oftentimes, they fail. Hopefully, they fail fast and cheap instead of slow and expensive. And it's oftentimes exploration where actually companies find the new sources of revenue and new business models. But exploitation is a winning bet. It's incremental. Companies pretty much know what's going to happen. Exploration is always risky. It's expensive, it's time consuming, and it may fail. So in essence, what companies need to do is to hit the right balance between exploration and exploitation. Exploitation is needed for the short term. Exploration is needed for the long term. But there is no long term if you fail in the short term. So new offerings are oftentimes actually something in between. We rarely see 100% exploration or 100% exploitation. So many new offering innovations are combinations of existing resources and new resources. On slide 4, you can find the good old Ensoff matrix, where you look at the newness or the oldness. First of all, in one dimension, you have technologies and products. Everything that is process-related, that is about innovation, that is about materials, that is about brands. And on the vertical dimension, you have customers and markets. Are they existing target groups or are they something completely new? Either in terms of geographic locations, demographics, or lifestyles. If it's old current markets and customers with existing technologies, that is where we have incremental offering development. At the other extreme, we have new customers and new markets with new technologies and products. That's where companies are operating in a very much uncharted territories. And then we have two mixed cases where actually one of them dimensions is something you're already comfortable with, and only one of them is something you need to investigate and develop from the capabilities perspective. I think the ends of matrix works best when you give examples, and that's what I want to do on the slide number 5. Let's look at, for example, Mars ice cream. It looks like the Mars chocolate bar. The shape is the same, the visuals are the same, even the packaging is almost like the family pack of Mars chocolate bars. So obviously, the reason why they made this kind of choice is because they wanted to maximize their share of wallet among their current customers and markets. Those whom are fond of Mars chocolate bars, but there is only so much chocolate one can eat per day. So in a way, if they want to keep on growing, they most probably cannot just simply sell the idea of eating a little bit more of the same old chocolate. That's why a category extension makes sense. So with this ice cream, Mars is definitely working in its current customers and markets, people whom are loyal to them, people whom they know exactly what kind of items and qualities the customers enjoy. But on the other hand, the technologies and products are definitely very new. Producing chocolate bars is so different compared to producing ice cream. Chocolate bars, it's a relatively easy product in a way, like that the best before dates are not a problem. You don't need any kind of complicated logistical supply chain. You don't need to work with low temperatures and so on. It's dry good whose shelf life can be months, if not even years. Ice cream is something different. Ice cream is sensitive. You need a completely different technology, different factory, different raw materials, different supply chain, and that is very vulnerable. Ice cream becomes inedible in case something goes wrong, even the tiniest detail. So that was definitely a learning journey for the Mars Corporation. I think the opposite is true for Toyota, that introduced the Lexus premium and luxury car brand years back. Actually, Toyota was quite comfortable with technologies and products. They were using their existing base. They knew exactly how to pull together a high-quality car. They just weren't familiar with high-end cars. The traditional Toyota didn't compete head-to-head with the German premium and luxury cars, or the even more luxurious Italian cars and so on. So they realized that most probably Toyota brand wouldn't stretch to this new market where customers have different drivers and values. And that's why they decided to face the facts. And while using their existing technologies and products, their process capabilities, their R&D, they realized they need a new brand in order to effectively reach the new customers and markets. The markets are actually the existing Toyota markets, where Toyota already has a market share. But what is new is the customer profile, the segment. People with different values, with completely different income, different ideal of what they expect from their cars. So existing technologies and products, but new customers and markets. On slide 7, I'm elaborating the concept of newness to the market. Sometimes the new offerings are not only new to the company that is innovating, but also new to the market. And that is where you need to take into account, actually, that you also need to budget time and money for educating the market of the new category. Actually, sometimes it is quite difficult to launch something never seen before in the market, because the first mover is in the marketplace pretty alone. There is no one else educating in the market. Your voice might not be heard. So sometimes we underestimate the the difficulty of introducing something new to the market. Many of the companies I've been working with have been suffering from this. And many of the smaller companies find this a paramount challenge because they are not having the deep pockets of large corporations. So even the innovations that are new to the marketplace, new to the customer, can be incremental. Something that improves what already exists, but in a way where consumers or customers in general find that the risk is not too high. Something that is better, new flavor, new packaging size, something that in a way like is manageable in terms of risk appetite. Sometimes the new to the market offerings are more disruptive, radical innovations that are architectural, that are bringing something new to the market from top to toe. Let's say launching a new category, combining existing categories and changing how they are being framed and positioned. Sometimes it can be a completely new technology or a combination of these. If you look at the slide number 7, it's important to understand that in a way like we need to be realistic when defining these offerings. How much does the customer value the innovation side in our offering? If they don't know how to use it, how to benefit from it, actually the additional money they are willing to spend might be relatively low. Only novelty isn't oftentimes enough. That's why it's important to understand that what really matters to the customer, how sensitive they are to the price, and then carefully work on your how to position the offering, what kind of value proposition to present, and how to price it. On slide number 9, actually, there is an interesting paper about certain myths we are having oftentimes about offering development. And these are not only about offering development, but also about the whole supply chain, the whole value chain of the company. Sometimes we think that high utilization rate of the process and the resources will improve performance. Sometimes that is true, but oftentimes actually it takes away the flexibility. And sometimes actually the best way to compete in the market is to guarantee the customer certain flexibility. Let's think about our SSAB steel case, where actually their ability to serve the customer with their very specific, oftentimes niche-related needs is actually giving them some competitive edge. You can don't have flexibility if your capacity is fully utilized. It can be illustrated on slide number 10, where actually the high utilization rate leads oftentimes to delays. When working with some real estate companies, actually, the interesting finding was that the ideal setup is not so that 100% of the space they have has been rented out, and there is 100% utilization rate. In every single building, in every single address, they always prefer having some flexibility, not much, but some, so that if one of the existing clients wants to grow and let's say 100, 200, 400 square meters more space, they are able to serve them and instead of facing the risk of losing a customer because there is no capacity to grow. Secondly, oftentimes we think that large batches make everything easier and cheaper. Sometimes that is true, but actually sometimes, as we can see on the slide 12, when the batch size grows, yes, the unit price, the transaction cost in a way goes down, but there is an issue that the holding cost, having your stock that is not yet paid by the client, that hasn't been delivered to the client, actually starts growing, and that's when the holding cost also grows. So the optimal batch size is in your supply chain process is always somewhere in between, and that is something you need to manage. What is large enough in order to give you the economies of scale, the benefits of scale, but also not an overkill in order to avoid having excessive stock that is just holding your capital, tying your capital and possibly not adding value and actually making your position in the market vulnerable, because naturally at some point you need to sell it as a company at any price in order to get rid of it. So in a way it's always operating on two dimensions. On slide 13, there are the remaining myths. Sometimes we overestimate the value of our own offering innovations because we know how much time and money we have spent on them. We know how painful the process was. And this is exactly the so-called sunk cost fallacy. And because we have already spent so much money and so much time on something, we need to carry on. We need to keep on working on that. And we need to stick to the plan. Maybe the client doesn't think the same way. So the sunk cost fallacy is a problem also when looking at the offering development. The fallacy number four is oftentimes that we try to keep on pushing the projects in order to get the offering soon to the market as quickly as possible. Sometimes it takes more time for the offering, but also the market to mature. For example, some of the food and beverage companies I've been working with have experienced that ideas they had, let's say, 10 years back are actually relevant now or are relevant like 7-8 years later. The market takes also sometimes some time to mature. Not only the end user and the client, but also the distribution network that you need to depend on. Fallacy number five is very typical. Sometimes we think that the more features our offering has, the better it is and the more customers will value it. This was actually a problem with many of the mobile phone manufacturers. Compared to Apple, that was able to scale everything down, keep the product extremely simple, make it the user experience and interface so easy that anyone can use it, and outsource these additional features to third parties, and that's where the market for applications started. Keeping the basic product simple and let the consumers decide from a huge selection what are the additional features they need. There is a pretty nice book by London Business School professors Patrick Barweis and IMD professor Sian Meehan about Simply Better. And I think the headline tells everything. Sometimes actually sticking to your core and being better there than any of your rivals will actually add more value to the customer and build customer loyalty and also help the customers to stay on board. The last one, the fallacy number six, is all about the first mover advantage. In many cases, that doesn't exist. If you look at the history of different categories and businesses, sometimes you realize that actually it wasn't the first mover who was the winner of the marketplace, but actually a fast second mover or third mover that had enough resources and capabilities to move fast, avoid the mistakes the first mover did, and come up with a better solution at a more reasonable price and with a stronger distribution. If you look at the number of categories, let's say famously Hewlett-Packard HP was able to take over the small-scale inkjet printer market by force after actually first watching the pioneers fail and struggle and so. So in a way, sometimes actually being the first mover doesn't add value, it only adds cost and risk. On slide 14, there are 12 items of advice for overcoming the fallacies. And some of them are more relevant in certain industries than others, but I think this is a very good checklist. Moving forward to slide number 15, where we speak about value innovations. How to create more value to the clients and by doing that justify higher prices. There are some basic approaches. First of all, sometimes we need to reconfigurate certain value dimensions of an existing offering category. Sometimes this helps us to come up with more incremental innovations instead of radical innovations. But let's say discount priced boutique hotels were actually they have quite a few new chains in the global market where they have realized that actually younger clientele appreciates good design, but doesn't need to necessarily want to spend that much time in one's room. So what has happened there is that the rooms are pretty small. It's the bed that takes like 1/3 of the space or so, minimalistically designed and decorated, but they have spent lots of effort on making amazing and impressive public spaces, bars, restaurants, coffee shops, where people can hang around, work, mingle, whatever they want. So in a way, working and maximizing the public space of the hotel and minimizing the square meters that are being wasted on the on the individual hotel rooms has been making it possible for them to have very, very competitive and aggressive pricing structures, and also make sure that actually many clients spend more time at the hotel, and spending more time means also spending more money on additional services. The second option is to build hybrids of existing products and offering categories, bringing together different categories that used to be working separately. Let's say when gas stations stopped selling only gas and repair services and car wash and so on, and started having their own mini markets there, and grocery stores and ready to eat offerings. That was actually bringing together the small scale grocery store and convenience store and traditional old school gas station. Sometimes they even gave up the additional car-related services like car wash or repair that were anyway underutilized in many cases, and allocated more square meters for the convenience and grocery business. The third concept of value innovations is finding a new core benefit or delivery innovation. Let's think about Netflix. Netflix started as a traditional streaming, traditional DVD rental company, where actually the benefit was that you can operate through post, so you don't need to keep on driving back and forth. But that wasn't the winning recipe. Over the years, they decided to move beyond physical DVDs and start working on streamed online content. And now they are actually making content available when you want it, where you want it, very easy access, low threshold. And they are bringing together their contents from multiple producers. They have their own content, but still majority of the content comes from third parties. So pooling contents together, you can find thousands of options any day in any category, and also delivering them flexibly when the client needs them. When thinking about value innovations, on slide 16, we have certain reflections every single company has to go through when thinking about its offering development. How much will the customers value the new offering thanks to its new value dimensions? Sometimes we are ourselves more excited than the actual end user or the client. So what is the price sensitivity, and how much extra could we charge? Or how much less should we charge in order to make our offering attractive? Secondly, how much could it cost to provide and deliver the new value dimensions? Sometimes building very complicated offerings actually makes your own cost base grow faster than the client's willingness to pay. And this is something we can actually also test in the market by asking our potential clients make trade-offs between different kinds of value dimensions. On slide 17, I think this is a good list of the considerations we need to have in order to build optimal choices, optimal combinations of different value dimensions. And moving forward on slide 18, are some of the warning remarks about new to the world, never seen before innovations. They are attractive. You can sometimes skim the market and ask for a pretty high price, especially when the category is new, because you always have these early adopters among the clients that are willing to pay the premium in order to get the access to the something never seen before. Also, new to the world offerings help us to escape competition, especially if the market is very crowded, the competition is price driven. This may sound very attractive. Sometimes your offerings haven't been available to certain segments in the market. They would be interested, they would benefit from them, but the problem is that they have been able to afford it or access the offering or so on. So value innovations, the new to the world innovations, sometimes help you to attract non-users that were outside of the market before. Let's say how Tata Corporation introduced this kind of very low-cost car in India and tapped into the lower middle class and blue-collar markets very fast. And sometimes, in certain cases, there can be first-mover advantages. Where actually you become the pioneer and the most wanted brand in the category because of being the first. New-to-the-world offerings have high potential in principle. But on slide 16, there are some of the considerations we need to also keep in mind. First of all, being the first means that you need to be able to carry the cost of developing a new offering. Oftentimes it's through trial and error, many prototypes, it's slow and full of disappointments. Sometimes the risks are also very high. The pioneers and first movers often fail. There are many first movers that have went bankrupt, and the second and third movers have capitalized on their innovation. On slide 20, sometimes the second movers, despite the fact that your company would be a pioneer and succeed, are able to move forward faster. They can avoid the mistakes you made. They can hire and recruit your best talent. They can try to imitate your processes, your design features, your capabilities. So second movers can oftentimes, by learning fast and imitating, they can free ride on the first mover's investment on R&D, employee education, market education, infrastructure, and so on. Someone else creates a category and then the second movers adopt the same standards and best practices and join the game. On page 21, I'm having certain considerations in regard to competition. Rivals will always imitate, and in the world of online social media, where actually everything is becoming more and more transparent and everything is becoming faster, the time you have in order to capitalize on your first mover advantage is getting so much shorter. The competitors can react in days or in weeks instead of months or years. So they can quickly drive down the pricing of first movers offering, so you are not able to capitalize on being the only one in the marketplace. And they can also challenge the market share and take some of the market for themselves. So it's better to anticipate that the price levels and the market share will go down faster than anticipated or aspired. We better budget for that as well. But on 22, you know, like there is some glimpse of hope for all the offering innovators. First of all, design something that cannot be imitated. You can use IPR and patents, or you can just have a very, very much of a signature design that, you know, like that is in a way not attractive for the copiers because it is so much linked to your brand and recognized and attributed to you. Sometimes you can develop customer switching barriers and costs. that it's very difficult for the customers to move forward. Let's say 12-month subscriptions, 36-month subscriptions, selling your offerings as services with long-term contracts, and so on. And sometimes transaction cost of switching would be so high that actually you keep on buying the products from your original innovator. Let's say that many companies, we are interested in this open code operating systems and software ecosystems. But actually, at the end of the day, pretty few large cap corporations was able to move beyond the Microsoft portfolio, because everything was interconnected, everything was linked. Replacing all that would have been terribly costly. Then naturally you can build brand loyalty, so that you have customers who are emotionally connected with you and your brand. They wouldn't consider changing and going anywhere else. And finally, there can be network effects of installed base. My Microsoft example, having thousands of users with tens of thousands of programs already in-house working for you, is actually giving you certain economies of scope and scale. And the same applies to many technological innovations, that actually, in a way, one mobile phone is not valuable. Having millions of mobile phones makes them all valuable because they can connect. Finally, on page 23, there are a few remarks about how could we innovate new clients, new customers. Sometimes companies can take different roles in the marketplace or change the customer's role. Sometimes the customer who uses your offering is not the same that pays for it. Think about mobile games that are targeted to children. Or sometimes the buyer is actually not the person who is actually using the product. So especially in business-to-business markets, we have lots of professional buyers who are buying products and offerings for someone else to use. And also our own position in the value network can change. Sometimes we can build more intelligent offerings that are, in a way, hybrids or combinations of existing offerings with something that makes them more valuable. Sometimes we can take a different role. We can become a value integrator. Nowadays, they speak lots about becoming a platform for something, the marketplace for something that is, in a way, bringing together different third parties, adding some additional value, giving a certain guarantee to the client, and then, in a way, like being able to extract some value from that. Being a marketplace, being an integrator. Let's say many of the online shopping platforms are taking this kind of a role in a more increased manner. Finally, one can try to be the value constellator. In a way, instead of trying to be a marketplace, becoming a player that is crucial for the whole marketplace to work, being almost like a lubricant for the whole value chain. Let's think about Visa, for example, the credit card. A global credit system that makes payments easy, or PayPal in online shopping, making transactions easy and making transactions safe, giving basic level services if something goes wrong, both for the retailers and the sellers, but also the consumers and the end users. So controlling this kind of grid makes them very powerful in the marketplace and helps them to capitalize on it. These were some of the remarks I wanted to make in regard to the innovation, offering innovation management. Should you have anything to ask or question or comment or add, which would be ideal, feel free to communicate in my courses or at some point during the next in-class session when working on the live cases. Thank you. Bye.